We made this.
This is The Way. I'm Ian Buckley, joined as always by Tim Dowd, and we are a Star Wars recap and discussion podcast here on the We Made This Network. Today we're talking about the third episode of The Mandalorian Season 3, The Convert, written by Noah Clore and Jon Favreau, directed by another recent Oscar nominee, Lee Isaac Chung, who is nominated for his screenplay for Minari, which was also nominated for Best Picture. I really like the fact that they're continuing to utilize emerging top Hollywood talent. Tim, what did you think of today's episode?
Yeah, remember how last week we discussed how I felt about the episode? I was like, 7.5, so I want to say, like, things would be better. Things would be 7.5, maybe an 8. This was a 9.5. This was one of the best episodes of the series, if not the series, and continues the alarming trend of, when does the show really come into its own? When its own main character just fucks right the hell off for the entirety of the episode.
Yeah, I think this was one of my favorite episodes so far, too. I have only watched it the once, so I want to revisit it. But, you know, the kinds of things that we were talking in the previous two episodes about what I wanted this show to be, this episode really started to explore some of that territory. This is Mandalorian, the action adventure serial show, plus this now, opportunity to add, much like we saw in Andor, some like contemporary political intrigue. Like we're getting this really fascinating glimpse for the first time into like New Republic society, like what Coruscant is like after the fall of the Empire.
Yeah, it's very... I know this didn't happen. Like, I know that, like, the way timelines and production schedules work, this didn't happen. This is what people are going to say happened. But this feels a lot like Jon Favreau got shown, like, sat down and watched Andor and went, oh, shit, okay, we can do that? Let's do that. Because, like, the second we leave behind Mando and Bo-Katan, in all the way, oh, by the way, a pitch-perfect, like, sequence of events of getting out there and ending up a starfighter fight and leaping through, like, truly amazing action sequence. For the moment they literally disappear in the cold opening and they say, we're going to go somewhere where they can't find us, and apparently where they go is somewhere that even the audience can't find them for the majority of the episode, we end up in what feels like a very different show. We're on Coruscant, we're not in the Wild West / Samurai like adventure show. Like, we are not in the dusty hills or swamps or whatever the hell that Ahsoka episode took place in. We are in the city of Coruscant dealing with complicated people who are now have to reckon with, like, what happens when you realize the whole government that you've been indoctrinated into, that you lived your life for, is gone and you have feelings about it.
Yeah. This was an opportunity for us to both have the exciting action while also exploring some deeper themes that Star Wars has been exploring its entire time, and now these shows are giving us an opportunity to dive a little bit more in depth and to get a little bit more detail into some of what we already knew happened, but also to give us fresh perspective on eras that we haven't seen depicted on screen yet, like the New Republic on Coruscant. Like, we haven't seen what the sort of upper crust of society is like in the New Republic era. Turns out, not too dissimilar from what they were like in Andor, which is to say, shitty.
Yeah.
Maybe all the people on Coruscant suck all the fucking time. I don't know, man. But yeah, it just seemed like a place that, and I say this as a bit of a city boy, we didn't mention this yet. We're sitting in your Manhattan apartment. Mm-hmm. So, like, we are very much in an urban setting right now. And saying all of that, I would fucking hate to live amongst these people.
Oh, yeah.
This sounds like the worst time to me.
Yes. Although I think what was funny, what I did love about it is they gave what felt like a very believably kind attempt. Like, you see, like, in this very, like, this is what the New Republic would try to do. This is how the New Republic would try to be more compassionate. And these are the flaws and the cracks and the things that that happen with a mechanism as massive as an intergalactic republic, if not an empire? And it's, you know, we're in Andor, we talked a lot about what we thought was so great is that they made everyone feel so human, even if they weren't human. They made everyone feel so three-dimensional, and while you didn't sympathize, is not the right word, you didn't agree with, like, these people's reasons for fascism.
You could understand where they were coming from their lived experience.
Yeah, they were not mustache-twirling villains. You could understand that they were,
these were not cartoon characters.
Yeah, you understand they were afraid of disorder, and this was preferable to anarchy in their mind, and they were indoctrinated to be scared enough at that as this rogue
for features. For the greater good.
And then it's interesting to then see, and I'm a little disappointed. No, I wasn't disappointed. The episode was great. But, like, to me, one of the most interesting snapshots, and ultimately this isn't really where our main two characters go, but the most fascinating snapshot was this amnesty housing and the others there, and the people there who are like, what happens when, like, you know, the Empire had been in existence by the time of Return of the Jedi, I think, for, like, 24 years? And it's also, like, it's not Vichy France or, I think I'm mixing up my historical terms, but it's not like German-occupied France where it's like a new government, the Empire is a new occupying force that came in.
You were right.
And you were a traitor to be joining it. You know, like, it was a gradual thing. You know, it's the government, which was ostensibly more democratic, turning fascist. And, like, what even, it's like, when you're, like, you're in your lifespan, you're raised in that thing, you're told that this is the right thing to do, and then you don't really, you know, when it's over, you're like, oh, I was on the wrong side. What do you do then? Like, what do you, it all, instead of just giving us characters who are believably fascist, this gave us characters who are believably, oh yeah, I would have made that choice. And I just, because I was born on that planet, just because I went to that recruiting station, and now I'm like, oh, I don't stand by that at all.
Yeah, and it is interesting to keep in mind, and we're getting with the exploration here of Coruscant society, more of a sense of, like, how relatively brief the Empire's time in the sun was. Like, it didn't last that long. Palpatine was not in power for that long. No. Like, it was, you know, he was admittedly in power during the last days of the Republic, but, you know, the Empire as it was not around for that long. Star Wars has been around for twice as long as the Empire was.
Right.
In the Star Wars universe. So there are people in this society who, especially given the sort of non-humanoid races who live, you know, like, very long spans of time, like, their perspective is like, oh yeah, like, the Republic was here before, then we had the Empire for a little while, and that was kind of bad. Well, except for us, like, we had the means to rise above it. But, you know, now it's the Republican. Well, we can't really tell the difference so much, but you know, like, how many people in society can really tell the difference.
Yeah. And it's, and to have that and to, you know, play with, because when you brought the time span, like, you're right, it's the span of Luke Skywalker's life. He is literally born on the birth of the Empire. And so the time between the end of the prequel trilogy to the beginning of the original trilogy is shorter, much shorter than the time from the end of the original trilogy to the beginning of the sequel trilogy.
Yeah.
Like, Luke's little hermitage is longer than the span of the Empire, which puts into a point of how bad the New Republic is at destroying the Empire, in that there are still, like, enough Imperial warlords to give birth to the First Order.
Well, we're starting to get a sense of that in this show.
Yeah.
Like, we're starting to get, like, we got a little bit in Mando Season 2, a sense of, like, okay, like, Gideon is involved with these Imperial remnants. He clearly has resources. Like, there are forces out there, dark forces still out there at work, at play. And now we're getting, in this episode, the first real sense of that impacting our main characters. You know, we start this episode with not the fight with the dragon that we were sort of anticipating last week, but we are getting Bo being attacked and her castle,
yeah,
being attacked by Imperial remnants, like TIE interceptors. A squadron of them come after them. They, as you said, have this really exciting escape sequence. They get out of the, they're out of the frying pan and into the fire, though, because they get back up into space, and there's even more Imperial forces coming out of who knows where.
Yeah.
And so there's clearly something going on there, and then we get this story on Coruscant with Dr. Pershing, which seems like it's tying into what's going on in the background here with whatever these Imperial remnants are up to.
Right. So it's like, right. I mean, and that's the biggest question is figuring out the motive of this double agent, this Alaya, yeah.
Yeah.
Of her thing, of figuring out, like, was she someone taking vengeance on him for being an Imperial remnant? Was this, like, a vigilante justice? Was this, like, oh, he works for the New Republic, so I'm going to, like, screw him over so they don't get his research, and is he an Imperial agent? I wasn't quite clear where she was coming from in her entrapment.
Yeah, right. Probably my only kind of ding against this episode is I would have liked, and maybe it'll become really clear in the next episode and I won't care anymore,
yeah,
but I would have liked just a little bit more clarity on, I don't need to know exactly what her angle is yet, but just the specifics of, like, did she need Pershing to retrieve this item from this starship? Like, she didn't seem to need his help getting access to it.
No.
And she seemed to know what he needed. She seemed to know where to find it. So I was sort of at a loss at the end of this episode. And again, I've only seen it once.
Yeah.
But of, like, what precisely she needed him for, if anything, or whether the whole point was to set him up, at which point I wonder, wasn't there an easier way to do it?
I do think it was entirely to set him up. I think that was the point. I think that all the items, all the stuff was just MacGuffins. It was just to motivate him so that he would fall into her trap.
Okay.
And I think it was all to get him in that chair. Maybe to help her, maybe help, like, because she is in the amnesty program. She seems to be genuinely, she's not an undercover agent or anything like that.
So I don't know for sure about that.
Well, it seemed like you said, there are lines said to her when she's behind the glass that it's like, you're still a success of this program.
She may still be pretending to be.
She might, but what I'm saying is not, she's a double agent, she's not a double agent of the New Republic. She's not like,
she's not a cop
who's been put into the rehabilitation to catch anyone who's slipping.
No.
She might be working for the Imperials, she might be working for other people.
I think she's still working with Gideon.
Oh, yeah. And we saw her in the previous season, right?
I don't either, but she was definitely there.
She was present. She doesn't, but both of these two actors, incredible performances, real top.
So good, absolutely lived in performances.
Really wonderful.
Yeah.
Performances across the board in this. I know I said some little things about Katie Sackhoff in last week's episode. In this week's episode, like, nails
everything.
Everyone nails everything 100%.
Yep.
But it was just such a beautiful, like, story of, like, I think he did want to, I don't think he was being a little weasel about it. Like, I think he did want to, like, I just care about the research. I don't really care about the politics.
I 100% believed him.
Yeah.
I think correctly. Like, I think he was being sincere in his, like, he was got tunnel vision about his scientific pursuits, which is a trope that we see in science fiction all the time.
Yep.
It is also one that we see in real life sometimes. But the sincerity with which he spoke about wanting to do well by the New Republic and wanting to make amends, like, that all read to me is 100% true.
Yeah. And I love that it's mixed with a very non-cartoonish pride. Because, right, like, he can be like, I could help people. It's like, yeah, but even if someone could do this research ethically, you know, which is already this kind of fishy clone genetic research ubermenschy thing that you want to do, even if there's someone who could do it objective, like, ethically, the New Republic is not wrong for being, like, maybe not the war criminal scientist. Like, maybe not you.
Right.
Maybe not the guy we're not executing, we're letting him back into society, we're doing all this stuff. We did catch you with some war criminals. So it's like, it's not unreasonable. And he can't accept that. Like, he can't even accept that, like, okay, maybe I can bring up this research, like, in a few years. Like, you've been in the program for, like, 6 months max. Like,
yeah.
the New Republic, but it's that beautiful thing of like, it's also very human of him to be like, to feel disgruntled by that and to feel like, no, but there's so much more we could be doing. And
right. You know, his personal research aside, what was so humanizing to me, and again, was this sort of very Andor-like shade of nuance that we're getting, is like his genuine frustration with the bureaucracy, with the waste, with the sense of like, no, but I know this was Imperial equipment, but like, the equipment doesn't have, it's not Nazi equipment, like, right? Like, it's just a wrench. It's not a Nazi wrench.
It's a wrench.
It's just a wrench.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he's like, this is like, wasting like a mass spectrometer. Like, it's just a scientific instrument. Like, it doesn't have an ideology. This is wasteful.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be doing this. And his response, the only response he gets is, fill out this form, which sounds like a nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like we got a smaller version of the sort of dystopian office workplace that we got a glimpse of in Andor a couple of times. And it does feel a little bit like, oh, yeah, like I could see this man feel like he's dying a slow death in here.
Yeah, exactly. And I can. And at the same time, it's like, I get also what, you know, it's beautiful, like, and just like, oh yeah, this stupid New Republic. And I'm like, I mean, it's like, I'm hard pressed to criticize the New Republic for not going full blown Operation Paperclip here.
I get it.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It is hard not to understand where each perspective is coming from, and that's what makes for a really compelling show and an episode of this series. And I'm really, really excited that like each episode is just improved on the last.
Yeah. And to your point, you know, we got little hints of this, but like, so when I first saw Force Awakens, what struck me, and this is not something I think the trilogy capitalized on. I don't know if this was something you even intended to capitalize on, but let's be real, not capitalizing on stuff was kind of the point of the sequel trilogy. But in the first movie, then the First Order is so young. You know, Hux, whatever it is, I think, Hux. General Hux is so young, and a lot of people we see are so young, and there's this feeling of like, the children of the Nazis that hid in Brazil. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they were brought up in this cult, being told all of these things about the outside world and about the other, the enemy.
Yeah. And disgruntled people who maybe be like, okay, maybe the New Republic in the time that we don't see them operates a bit like in Fallout, the New California Republic, which is well-intentioned, overly bureaucratic, and maybe as a result not that efficient at keeping things safe, at keeping people giving people a sense of security. And because they don't have that sense of security, ultimately that ends up with a lot of people being like, I understand I may have less freedoms, but I'd like to not get mugged at night. And that's what turns you into that fascist ideology in a more reasonable, less mustache twirly way.
Yeah. No, it is very clearly the road to hell is paved with good intentions situation that we have Dr. Pershing set up on by this Aliyah Kane character, who we aren't sure exactly what her angle is, but we feel very sure by the end of this episode that it is not a good one.
No.
She is not our friend. She is not one of the good guys.
No. She is. I'm fascinated to see what we do with her. If she disappears from the series after this thing, we'd be very disappointed.
Like you said, I know she was in season two, but I don't remember her making a very big impression.
Yeah.
So it is interesting and great to see this kind of background character almost elevated to be given such a meaty role. I don't think this will be the last time we see her, but like, even if it is, like, what a knockout performance in this episode.
I don't expect to see much of Dr. Pershing ever again. I might see like a bubbling girl-ness later.
Yeah.
But
lacks security on that situation.
Oh God, real.
And like, how much of like a like Kafka-esque nightmare did that feel like?
Yeah.
Like it felt like the end of fucking Brazil. Like, it felt like something out of Brazil.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like, no. You haven't even heard my side of the story. Please stop strapping me into this machine.
Yeah.
I recognize the machine. I know what this machine is
capable
of doing. And they're like, no, don't worry. At like low frequencies, it's fine. Well, why the fuck does the dial still go to 11?
Yeah, I know.
Why does the dial even go to 11? Why isn't this setting the max setting?
That's true. That is true. It's like, he does seem to be okay at the lower level. Like, he's like, no, like the Mon Calamari.
I don't think the doctor's lying. Yeah, I don't think the doctor's lying. I think the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I think the doctor is genuinely like, no. We totally, like, recalibrated this torture device. It's fine. I did it. It's great. You get a little bit of a buzz, which, like, I believe it's like taking a... Like, it's like ingesting a small amount. It's all about the dosage. It's like ingesting a small amount of a toxin and having, like, a hallucinogenic experience as opposed to a fatal experience.
Well, yeah, or, like, electroshock therapy.
Exactly.
Which, speaking of Star Wars, Carrie Fisher, famous recipient and proponent, advocate of it. But because of things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and a lot of, frankly, poorly researched... I mean, yes, some sketchy history, but also some really poorly researched... ideas of how it works and how it's used and its implementation in modern medicine society, very, very heavily frowned on. But also, one of the things about it, never given to someone against their will like it is done here.
Right.
So it has that element of that. But cool boy. Yeah, I wasn't sure what was going to happen there, and then as soon as she goes to the dial, it's like, oh boy.
Yeah, as soon as the guy leaves her alone in the room, I'm like, oh no. His brain's going... Like, if this was an R-rated show, his brain would explode. His head would explode.
Yeah, it seems like maybe she's building the rebellion to the rebellion, maybe, in there. There's a part of me, I don't think this is what's going to be, there's a part of me that's like, I would not mind following her as, like, a Punisher-esque Nazi hunter, just thing like, I hunt down old Imperials and just pound them and murder them.
I wouldn't mind if she was like, turned out to be one of, maybe not the quote-unquote good guys, but some sort of like rogue actor who is involved in like what ends up being the resistance, Leia's resistance. And instead, I feel like she's most likely one of Gideon's agents and is working his agenda, his angle, whatever it may be at this point.
Yeah. But oh my goodness, what an app. I mean, the one quibble I can give the whole episode is he's like, we have this mobile lab unit thing. And then he gets there and everything he needs to run this lab, to do this DNA, whatever the hell research he's doing, this Star Wars gobbledygook that he wants to do, fits into one cooler size box.
It's a Rolly suitcase.
Yeah, and I'm like, that's it?
Yeah.
It's quite a mobile lab unit. I was really expecting at least two suitcases.
Yeah, I was really expecting this to be a four-hand job, carrying this out of there. This is a little surprising. Feels like something she could have just gotten for you.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely feels like something she could have picked up. Oh, such a good episode.
Yeah, very good episode. What did you think about... We had this bookend story where basically we have Bo and Din at the beginning getting chased out of the Mandalore system by Ties, and then we sort of assumed the place he would take her would be the covert where the rest of his cult is, and that is, in fact, where he takes her.
Yeah.
And he brings back proof that he's been in the living waters.
So he does it. He gets his thing. He's atoned. He has reached atonement, other than like a little bit of squabbling before he gets in, like the people doubt it.
Yeah. Paz Vizsla, is that his name? I always forget his name.
I don't remember. The big jerky one.
He's a dick. So sick of this fucking dude.
I know.
His attitude sucks.
He does. But it's like, I get it. He's got to have that one, like, oh, I don't know about this guy. And it's like, you need that.
I get it.
That little schmuck.
I'm over his deal, though. I can't wait for Bo-Katan to, like, lop his head off with a darksaber.
Yeah. But it does feel like I kind of saw it coming, because I did clock that, like, she hasn't taken her helmet off since she went in the water.
Yes, I thought that was a cool touch.
And I thought that was an interesting thing of, like, oh, she's no longer an apostate, she's in. And it didn't feel like that was part of her plan, but now she suddenly finds herself welcomed into a culture after being abandoned by her own troops, of being abandoned by their own things, now finds herself with the darksaber, welcomed into a group of people who now know that Mandalore isn't cursed. It just suddenly feels like this is the beginning of her army again. It feels like this is the beginning of, like, her play for power. The question might become, I don't know if the this covert is going to follow Bo over following the armorer in the way they have been.
I mean, you know, we didn't pick up where we thought we might with her slaying the dragon, but we essentially do continue the story of her finding her way back to the way.
Yeah.
And her being welcomed immediately by this cult who she's been so disparaging of. I do wonder if maybe we're going to see, like, this... a resurgence of this particular sect of the creed, of the belief system, if they're the ones who succeed in being led by the wielder of the dark saber and are the ones who are able to spread the word that, you know, Mandalore is not actually cursed. Like, I wonder what they're going to do with that. Hard to tell with the helmet on, but it does seem one imagines she's being affected by that immediate, like, embrace of camaraderie by this group.
Yeah.
After she's been abandoned by these people who she's led for, like, a decade.
So I have a question you might know the answer to. When is the first time? Is it the Mandalorian Episode 1 the first time we get this whole, like, you can't take your helmet off thing? Because I know, like, we have...
That has never been seen before.
Yeah, so it's like, because we have Jango Fett... Like, I was, like, wondering, like, what creator did this? Is this a Lucas? Is this a Jon Favreau? Is, like, where did this element come from? Because, like, we have Candor's Ordo in that.
I could be misremembering.
Jango Fett, but obviously Jango Fett feels like the definition of an apostate.
Yeah, I could be misremembering, you know, a particular detail from one of the episodes of the animated series that involved the Mandalorian arcs and Bo-Katan and all of that. There might have been some of that, but no, as far as I know, there was no mention. Everyone was popping their helmets off left and right. It was no one even, that's why it seemed so surprising. It was like, oh, like I didn't remember that being a thing. Maybe that's and I was thinking, like, oh, maybe that's where Mandalorian culture just is at this point in Star Wars after whatever has, like, I know that, like, Mandalore was laid waste, but, like, we've, as far as anything that has appeared on screen in live action, like, we don't know any better, you know? So, like, and as far, you know, the last things that we saw in, you know, the animated stuff was all, well, I guess Rebels was during the era of the Empire and Mandalore was still around. But, so this was the first thing that we had seen since Mandalore was destroyed, and so I didn't know if maybe this was something that the survivors after that happened had done, like, in response to that. So it wasn't until Bo-Katan showed up with, like, her helmet under her arm that I was like, oh, there's something else going on.
That this is created by the show.
It seems to be, yeah. And that's my recollection.
And the cult idea kind of helps reconcile that, like,
it could be something in the comics that I'm not familiar
maybe,
with. But
maybe,
I don't think.
I was just wondering. I was curious about that because I was like, is this just trying to, like, make all these things, like, connect? It's like, this is a cool idea, but it doesn't match up with the rest of what we've seen. So it's like, all right, let's make this a thing. Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm glad to see them all together. I hope more stuff happens. I'm happy that the show has.
Yes, I too hope more stuff
happens. I hope more stuff happens. I'm enjoying both. It just, like, it again makes the first episode look even worse. To be like, we have these characters, these storylines, and you wasted our time with this pirate bullshit.
I don't disagree. I'm hoping that there ends up being a link there. Like, I'm hoping that, like, the pirates are being secretly backed by these Imperial remnants. Something. Like, I'm hoping for some sort of relevance because, yeah, it does end up feeling like, man, which we said over and over again in Boba Fett, which was like, man, we've only got 8 episodes. Like, can we really be affording to, like, waste any of the time that we have?
Yeah.
And they're not shy with making longer episodes. Like, this one was a longer episode. It was certainly longer than Episode 1. And, yeah, it just didn't feel like the best use of anyone's time. It just felt so unfocused. Yeah. And ultimately, like, the whole droid side quest was, like, useless. What was the point? Yeah. What was the point?
Yeah, I'm hoping if they bring the level of writing, the level of, like, nuance and human character, and they return to Greef Karga, and we explore, maybe a scumbag can't become legit that easy. You know, maybe like that's like what we really kind of explore.
I loved for there to be a, like you said, a well-written character piece focused on Greef Karga and his corner of the galaxy and trying, yeah, like yeah. make this show a serialized show about like, let's see what like life is like in the margins on Coruscant. Let's explore this New Republic era. And yeah, have this Mandalorian character kind of like weaving through as this wandering figure.
Yeah, I did have a thought that, one, this is a really random quibble I have the show, but by it being set in Coruscant, which we know and love, or hate, really, when it took about halfway through the episode to realize we were on Coruscant, to know for a fact we're on Coruscant. Part of me was hoping we were on the other planet, which has gotten so little time, I don't know the name of it, but the one we see blown up in Force Awakens, which is apparently, the by that time in this Star Wars history, the seat of the Galactic Senate.
You're right. I, too, forgot the name of that planet, and...
But the fact that we're forgetting means, like, oh, for that for them to retroactively make that planet getting destroyed mean something, we gotta do some stuff there. It's like...
Right.
It's like the amount of stuff, like, how much of the prequels is set on Alderaan. You know, just to be like, Alderaan, what a lovely planet I have.
Yeah.
Be a shame if something happened to it.
Be a real shame if something happened to it. Whatever the hell the name of that planet is.
If you know the name of that planet, please message us.
Please let us know if you know.
Because I'm not going to Google it. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, I'm not checking on Wikipedia. But it is...
That's the weirdest pronunciation of Wikipedia ever.
Wikipedia. I said...
Wikipedia.
What was I saying?
Nothing.
So the name of that fucking planet, whatever it might be, you're right, it wouldn't be a bad idea for them to set some of this action... in this show, these shows on there that are in the New Republic era, give us a little bit of, it's a bit of retcon, it's ret context.
Oh yeah, ret context, yeah, exactly. I like that, ret context.
Otherwise, yeah, it was a little anonymous seeming at first, but then they got into it as they started moving around the planet more and talking about it more, and I liked the little detail about the mountain peak.
That was such a cool moment.
Cool little detail. Pershing and Alaya are wandering around in this square on Coruscant, and they see like a rock, which at first looks like maybe it's like a sculpture or a monument or, you know, some sort of like, oh, this was a piece of some planet that was destroyed, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a piece of something. And it turns out that it's the top of what is apparently the tallest mountain on the surface of Coruscant. So it has a surface and has mountains, and this is apparently the very top of one.
Yeah.
So like this city planet has been so built over so many millennia that like the tallest mountain on the surface of this planet, the very peak of it is at the street level of this highest level of Coruscant. That's wonderful world building.
Yeah, oh my god, that's great. And it's you know, very rarely we explored how deep we go in there. I think in the original Knights of the Republic, I think we hit the ground level of Coruscant. Yeah,
you know,
deep.
You get a little bit of that sort of thing on like Kashyyyk too, where in the game you like go down to the floor of the planet. You're not in the trees proper where most of the action generally takes place, and it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And similarly, like, I would imagine anything that, like, took place, like, this is the exact kind of thing that just, I was about to say as a kid, but, like, fuck that, as an adult, like, it just sends my mind, like, spinning in all these directions of what sort of stories could they tell of Coruscant street urchins, like, exploring in the bowels of the city, finding a way to access the surface, or, like, beneath the planet city.
Yeah, good stuff.
Great stuff. Yeah, really good stuff. And where we leave things at the end of the episode, the new status quo is Bo-Katan and Din are both redeemed and back in the fold of the cult.
This never lasts for more than about 7 minutes, but like we are once again at the end of a Din Djarin quest. He has nothing to do. Like he's done it. He's redeemed. He has Grogu. Everything is fine.
It's interesting, you know, because we got this quest in Book of Boba Fett, technically. The first of the Mandalorian episodes in that show was when the armorer told him, you are an apostate now because you removed your helmet and you must do this to be redeemed. And he's been on this quest since that point. So really, we've only had him on this quest for 3 episodes of this show proper.
Yeah.
And now he needs a new one.
Yeah, and you could tell, as much as I love having Bo on the show, she's about to blow up his ship. Because I think Din is still the one carrying the Darksaber right now, and so it feels like...
Oh, is he? Did she give it back?
I think, based on my understanding of the characterizations, she would have felt obligated to return it to him. But I don't actually know that for a fact.
See, I'd have to rewatch that episode because there was some specific lore, but part of me wonders whether Bo cares anymore.
Right.
Because she's at this point where she's just sort of like, what's the point of any of it? Like,
yeah.
Like, this is all stupid superstition. Like, she was so dismissive about, like, the living waters and their power. Like, why would she, like, hew so closely to, like, this particular nuanced little bit? Especially since, like, at the time, keep in mind, when that was all happening, she still had all her followers, like, who could see what was going on.
Sure.
Like, if she had been alone with Din, like, when they... like encountered Gideon and they never encountered anyone else, nobody else ever knew, like they could have worked something out. Like Din doesn't need this Darksaber. Like,
no, he doesn't want it.
He doesn't want it. So I think that like maybe the fact that it was taken from him, you know, by that, you know,
creature.
Cyborg thing, and that she recovered it and then successfully wielded it and saved him with it. Like maybe she's like, nah, it's mine now.
Maybe, and I think no one would argue with that. I mean, it is a question of like, because it seemed to be the idea of like, oh, the only way to get the saber is by winning it off of the person in a duel, seemingly to the death. But yet, she honors his possession. She seems to honor Gideon's original possession of his saber, which he didn't kill her to take it.
No, but I think he killed whoever the last wielder of it was.
Well, wasn't she the last wielder of it? Because she has it in the cartoon, right? Like,
I'm going to have to refresh my memory about what happens to it.
Got it. Okay. But I'm just looking at, like, how does he get it in a way that she needs to respect the obligations
of? Yeah, I don't remember the chain of custody, but I can also put that question out there to folks who remember.
Yeah, or anyone listening, please. But anyway, it feels a little bit like, you know, the end of Harry Potter, when it's like, oh, that wasn't really my wand, or what, you know, like some weird little, like, wait, how does it,
yeah.
You know? I'm like a little lost on
I
that
feel
part.
Like they could find a loophole to get her this saber, but she may be too prideful to.
Let's say now she's becoming more faithful, or at least is willing to experience the faith. Question is if she's going to be genuine about it, or if she's like, I can use this to my favor.
Right. She also, I'm curious about how sincerely she will embrace what's happening at the end of this episode, like long term. Because while I think she's happy, is probably willing to go along with the, okay, I guess I'll keep my helmet on at all times thing. Like, I would be surprised if once she leaves, she isn't like back to popping her helmet off.
Yeah, right. And so that's, you know, the question though. But like, you know, we're kind of talking that like Din has seemed to be a source of inspiration rather than her taking him out of this religious world, he seemed to bring her inspiring her into it.
Exactly.
So it made me question, like, oh, is she born again?
Right. Well, the title of this episode is The Convert.
Yeah.
So, you know, it may be a utilitarian kind of conversion now, but that doesn't mean that at some point it won't become more genuine.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it's interesting now that we know, and the cult knows, that the surface is not cursed, that people can just go to the living waters. It is interesting because it is very much like a very religious concept to be like, you're a cast out, you're a sinner, but like, dunk yourself in this water and like, all is forgiven.
Yeah.
You're fine. Like, theoretically, like, they could all go, like, I guess, like, according to this cult, like, you could just go pop off your helmet, become an apostate, take a stroll over to the living waters, take the creed, walk back out with your helmet on, and you're fine.
Yeah.
Like,
got
nothing.
Real, got
it's
real,
got
like,
some real Catholicism, like just confess your
last wishes.
Yeah. It's got a real, like, just go to confession and you're forgiven. You'll go to heaven. Just, you know, beg Jesus for forgiveness and you'll go to heaven. Doesn't matter what you did, as long as you repent before you die, you're fine.
Yeah. It was an interesting thing of like, well, now I'm wondering, like, in my mind, the next logical thing is the convert should move to Mandalore.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't discuss at some point, like, what does, like, resettlement, is that possible? Because, like,
yeah.
Nothing's growing on the surface.
No, anymore. No. So it doesn't look like so, it's like, vegetative.
Right.
I don't think these guys are farmers.
There are some.
Lifestyle.
No, but, like, there are some things living down there. So, like, maybe there is hope for some existence to be carved out. At the very least, it seems like there's no reason you can't colonize, like, the moon, recolonize, like, the moons.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think we actually talked about this on mic. Like, I was fascinated to learn last week that Din, like, was from one of the moons of Mandalore. Like, when he was discovered, we only see that he's discovered by them. Like, we don't really have, like, confirmation that he's from any particular place. Like, I just sort of, like, I got that he was an orphan, but, like, I didn't assume that he was on any particular planet or moon. Like, I didn't think he was from literally Mandalore.
Oh, that's too. That's
because, like,
I read.
Because, like, he said he wasn't from Mandalore, so I just sort of assumed he wasn't from Mandalore, like, system.
I didn't read his statement as he was found on one of the moons of Mandalore. I read that as wherever he was found, he was brought to one of the moons of Mandalore and raised and trained.
Oh.
And so he never got to go to the planet of Mandalore, but he was raised and trained there. So that's why he identifies as coming from, maybe not necessarily, I don't think we ever find out.
I thought he meant he was found there.
No, you might be right, but that's not how I read it. I read it as that is where he was brought to, and
fair.
That is now how he, you know. Because Din Djarin, I don't even know if we remember if that's a name given to him by the Mandalorians, or if that's his name that, like, his parents gave him before they were slaughtered by trade droids and whatever.
Yeah, I don't remember. But it is cool to see that there is now, like, a new path forward for the first time for the Mandalorians at large, because now they have confirmation that the planet isn't cursed.
Yeah.
And they have the Darksaber. But it's clear that there are Imperial remnants, I'm presuming, you know, Gideon's forces, that are also hunting down Bo. So these forces are going to come to a head at some point soon.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts about this week's episode?
No, not really specific to this episode, no.
All right. You want to plug your socials?
Yeah. You can always find us at Plansy Productions on YouTube, on Instagram. You can also find our movie, Three Way, feature available on Vudu, Amazon Prime, and a whole bunch of streaming platforms that I did not know existed until they started sending me checks.
And you can follow this show on Twitter and Instagram at The Way Pod and at The Way Is This Pod, respectively. You can hear me talk about Trek on We Are Starfleet, Severance on Illumination Above All, Movies on Movieversaries, and a bunch of other stuff elsewhere around the network. Thanks for joining us for another episode, and remember, we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network. Please subscribe to The Way and give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Star Wars isn't all we discuss on the network, so we'll give you a taste of what you might have missed out on in just a moment.
Are you a fan of the Marvel Universe?
Can you tell your Kang from your Doctor Doom?
Well, if so, boy, do we have a podcast for you.
Podcast 616 is the We Made This Network's long-running Marvel podcast, and it's under new management.
We're your hosts, Ashley Thomas.
And Hugh McStay.
And together, we are going to lead you every step of the way through the Marvel Cinematic Universe's upcoming multiverse saga.
Everything from She-Hulk to Avengers Secret Wars will be covered on the podcast in the kind of detail that would make a Wikipedia article blush.
We're going to have some detours into the wider Marvel world where we'll look at non-MCU projects dating all the way back to Marvel's origins in the groovy, funky 60s, and all the way up to the birth of the greatest franchise in cinema history.
And we'll be joined on our adventure by a roll call of guests so impressively knowledgeable that they'll make the Avengers themselves look clueless by comparison.
So if you like your opinions sharper than Wolverine's claws,
or takes hotter than the Human Torch's underpants,
then get Podcast 616 in your ears as a matter of urgency.
You love it 3000.
Podcast 616.
Disassemble.